Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. The format today is discussion, but we have three short presentations to sort of catalyze that. The first will be Richard Woodard, then we'll have Will Donnelly, and then Don Merrill. And so people are encouraged to ask them questions as part of the discussion, and we'll go from there. So, Richard.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me here. It seems like a fascinating conference, and I'm looking forward to talking with everybody here about this. So I'd like to focus on single scalar inflation, just to have something definite to talk about. But of course, questions of observables in quantum gravity are much, much broader than that, and those issues can and should be addressed. But I think it's also important to have a definite focus, because there's where we have some data, and with more on the way, and it looks like that's a good good thing to try and resolve, because there are clear problems even at that level. So just to be in the interest of being completely clear, I'm talking about this class of models, which everybody has seen many, many, many times before. And you know that one nice way to formulate this theory is to do it in the context of the ADM formalism. So take the invariant element to be that. But then break with the usual ADM procedure, which is to regard N and Ni as gauge conditions, to instead impose other gauge conditions and regard N and Ni as constrained variables that we solve for. And the other gauge conditions, I have to specify a little bit about the three metric first to define the other gauge condition. Deep sigh. So where this guy is a traceless matrix. And the other gauge conditions are, first, that the full scalar just agrees with its classical result that fixes the time gauge. And second, that the graviton field, in addition to being traceless, is also transverse. That fixes the spatial gauge conditions. And then you know that what you do is to go ahead and solve for the constraint equations. That can be done, interestingly, exactly for N, but can only be done perturbatively for Ni. It gets very hard very quick. At the end of some heavy agony, you get the two dynamical fields are zeta, the scalar perturbation, and Hij, the graviton field. And at the end, the quadratic Lagrangian, after a bewildering number of partial integrations and everything, takes the form working out the vertices, and this is really, really complicated and has only been done to a few of the lowest orders. But you can already see from this that an important thing, zeta propagators are going to go like 1 over that. So zeta propagators are going to go like g over epsilon.
Remind people what epsilon.
Epsilon, yes. Thank you, Steve. So if you have the scale factor, you can get two derivatives of it. First is the Hubble parameter, A dot over A, and second is the so-called first slow roll parameter, which is defined as minus H dot over H squared. We actually have data on this, assuming single scalar inflation and the latest Planck results concatenated with all other data sets. Let's see, the measured value for the scalar amplitude and the limit on R tell us that during inflation at the time that the perturbations were, that we can measure, were eliminated, epsilon is very, very close to its de Sitter value, and the dimensionless combination of G and the Hubble parameter is less than about 4.2 times 10 to the minus 11. And let's see, getting back to these quadratic Lagrangians, you can see that the zeta-zeta propagator is going to have a factor of 1 over epsilon in it. It's also, of course, dimensionful, and in cosmology, when we're talking about these kind of processes, dimensionful factors always get resolved to be factors of H. So this is actually going like that. Jim?
Your first gauge condition, which says that the field is going to be equal to the classical one.
Yeah.
But the classical one, is it classical coupled to gravity? Is there some sort of...
Yes.
And two, it requires boundary conditions to specify that.
So the classical field obeys these equations. And I think you probably mean initial conditions, or did you mean spatial boundary conditions?
Initial conditions.
Okay. So it obeys those equations, and so what I want is to take any initial condition that will allow slow roll inflation to occur, and then use that initial condition and solve the scalar field, such that it obeys its scalar equation.
But H depends on time too.
Yes, last time I checked.
So we take any slow roll solution to the problem.
Or, interestingly enough, you could play the game the other way around. If you had a favored expansion history, A of T, mm-hmm. you can use these two equations just to construct what phi would be and what V would be. And in fact, that's sometimes interesting, is just to take your favorite A and say, that's the one I want to use, and work with everything in the so-called Hubble parameterization.
Okay, thanks.
So we can see again that the zeta-zeta correlator, the zeta-zeta propagator, has this infamous factor of 1 over epsilon. Hugely, hugely, hugely important, because epsilon is so small. 1 over epsilon is greater than about 175, a number which might eventually be as famous as 137. And you can see from the kinetic term of the graviton field that it doesn't have that factor. Okay, the two power spectra that we deal with seem to be represented as operators by these formulae. Expectation value in the FRW analog of Bunch-Davies vacuum, that is the one which is minimum energy in the infinite past, or in the distant past. And that you could express exactly in terms of the free scalar mode functions. Call them V of T and K, and this is to be evaluated a long time after first horizon crossing. Same here. First horizon crossing is K is equal to H of T sub K, A of T sub K. However, we can't evaluate these things. So the first embarrassment is that far from being able to do anything non-perturbatively, we can't even do an exact tree order calculation in any realistic theory, because we don't know these mode functions. We have approximate formulae for them. The approximate result is that, which, again, you can see has to be true because it's a zeta-zeta correlator, hence it has to have that famous factor of 1 over epsilon. We know the exact slow roll corrections, so we know the corrections to infinite order in the slow roll approximation, but there are guaranteed, and we can see it explicitly from cases that we can solve explicitly, there are guaranteed to be non-local correction factors multiplying this thing that would occur if you had epsilon evolving, and we don't have an analytic expression for those things.
Is it obstruction computing them numerically if you really want to know the answer?
There is no obstruction except difficulty for computing it numerically. So if you give me an A of T, we know exactly what to do to get that thing. What we would do is to solve this differential equation. Subject to the Wronskian normalization condition. And we would evolve it, we know from Hadamard form, we know the behavior of this guy in the far, far ultraviolet, that is when k squared is very much bigger than h squared a squared. So we would evolve from that form that we know past horizon crossing and then plug in to this formula. And indeed, it's doing that for explicit expansion histories that tell us that there must be corrections to that guy. So we can get it numerically, but we cannot get even exact tree order calculations. That's kind of embarrassing, but true. And the graviton one, is close analog of that guy. With a sum over the indices, which will, of course, resolve into a polarization sum, also evaluated a long time after first horizon crossing. And that you can express exactly in terms of the graviton mode functions. It would be 32 pi g times a 2 for the polarization sum times u of t and k evaluated a long time after first horizon crossing. And that is approximately 16 over pi times g h squared of t sub k. Again, we have the infinite order slow roll approximation corrections. So if epsilon is not equal to 0, the de Sitter value, but constant, we know exactly what the result should be. In fact, why be mysterious? I'll just tell you it's 1 over pi gamma squared of 1 half plus 1 over 1 minus epsilon times 2, 1 minus epsilon to the 2 over 1 minus epsilon. But we don't know, we know that epsilon can't be constant. Both the data tell us that and common sense tell us that. If epsilon was constant, inflation would never end. The data also constrains r and n sub s, and epsilon equals constant is a straight line. The data looks like that. And all constant epsilon models are ruled out. So there is a factor here which we think is order one, but we don't know explicitly. So it's embarrassing that we can't even calculate the tree order results.
Sorry, why is it embarrassing? That, you know, normally you can't solve exactly a differential equation. That's all that's happening here.
Well, I guess I was trained in particle theory, right? And things like the Klein-Nishina formula in particle physics, we get exact results for that, right? At a fixed order,
exact.
Pardon?
It's not exact.
At a fixed order in perturbation theory, we get exact results, and we can't even do that here. So I'm a little bit embarrassed by that. But if you're not, that's okay.
You wouldn't be able to do Klein-Nishina in a time-dependent background.
Right.
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't be able to do Klein-Nishina in a time-dependent.
Sure. It's exactly the same problem. It's that there's a heavy, heavy time dependence, so the background is different, and the background makes the calculation much, much more complicated. We can get exact results for graviton scattering amplitudes in flat space, so you're exactly correct. That's true, but that's the thing where we have data. That's the universe that we live in, and it's I don't know, a little bit embarrassing to say that we can't get exactly even the tree order result, right? And it might matter, too, because if you imagine renormalizing these things, you're going to, you know, say it was multiplicatively renormalizable, you're going to have an infinity times one of those small factors that you're going to be trying to subtract away I think we really need to do a little bit better than that, but maybe I'm being too severe.
Maybe you said this, omega is any old vacuum, or is it Bunch Davis?
It's the, I did say it, it's the FRW analog of Bunch Davis, Bunch-Davies vacuum. That is, it's the state which was minimum. This is all free field theory, and it's actually a harmonic oscillator, mode by mode by mode. And at any instant, there's a minimum energy state, right? Mm-hmm. However, there's a time-dependent mass and a time-dependent frequency. This vacuum is the de Sitter, or is the FRW analog of Bunch-Davies vacuum, which is the one which is minimum energy in the distant past. Okay? Other questions? Okay, so like I say, it's kind of embarrassing that we can't even, to me, that we can't even do this at tree order, but the problems I really wanted to talk with you about have to do with loop corrections to this. Okay, because we can calculate loop corrections to that. That, of course, entails working out what the interaction vertices are. Really, really hard. We're fortunate that we have the people who did the key results here. I think one was the first person to get the three-point vertex. And it has, of course, the factor of 1 over g that all gravitational interactions have to have. It also has, after a lot of work, a factor of epsilon squared. And remember, all dimensionful constants get resolved in this business into h. So it's got a 1 over h squared. And the general rule, and I think, let's see, Martin, if he's here. Martin, are you here?
I'm okay. Right there.
Martin was the one who did the four-point diagram. That also has an epsilon squared. And those are not easy calculations to do. The general rule seems to be that the vertex could have any number of h's. And if it has 2n or 2n minus 1 zetas, should be, then it picks up an epsilon to the n over g h squared. Okay? Really, really, really important factor for our discussion, because that means that loop corrections do not inherit this factor of 1 over epsilon, which is the whole reason within the context of single scalar inflation that we have resolved this thing to three significant figures and not yet resolved that thing.
Sorry, I'm just going to, you keep saying single scalar inflation, but you really haven't done that in a generality. This is, doesn't matter for what you're really saying.
I haven't?
No. You can write a much more general action for a single scalar field.
You think of adding stuff to gravity or adding a conformal coupling? What?
Non-minimal kinetic terms, right?
Yeah, that's usually most.
Yeah, adding a conformal coupling then, right?
No, non-minimal
just coupling. Just a general function of...
Higher derivative coupling terms?
Yeah, so you get an extra parameter which boils down to the sound speed of the perturbation.
Okay, great.
Just, yeah,
so you're thinking of like K essence?
Yeah, that's an example.
Okay, sure. This is what I mean by single scalar inflation, but you're right, those models do have one scalar. So let me call this a scalar potential model. How about that?
Just slow roll inflation, sure.
Okay. Okay, so in any case, I defined exactly what I mean by it, even if the word is irritating to people. So getting to the issue about epsilon suppression, this factor of 1 over epsilon, which you can see every zeta propagator is going to entail, is really, really important because it's the reason that we can see this guy and we haven't yet seen that guy. Okay, that has to do with loop corrections. So loop corrections involve putting an interaction vertex.
Is there an easy way to see this counting of powers of epsilon?
No. At least I don't know any easy way to do it. The actual calculations are, I would say, tour de forces of even to get this. There's about 10 different terms that start out, and you have to do massive integrations by parts and everything, and cancellations occur, and you start out with terms that look like they aren't epsilon suppressed, and then they all wind up canceling so that you have just an epsilon factor in the end, and these things are even harder. And nobody has the general form of it. We think it goes like this, but nobody has worked out what the general result is, and I think it's going to be a long, long time before anybody does. Like I say, you can solve the n constraint exactly. There is an algebraic solution for that, but figuring out what that is only known perturbatively.
There are papers giving the scaling, right? I mean, there are papers giving the scalar, the scaling with epsilon for different n fine correlation functions.
Yeah, and I think it goes like that.
So time is limited, so let's move on, or try to get towards the observables.
So what I'm worried about is loop corrections to this. So people can calculate loop corrections to this. It involves knowing the putting in a vertex correction. And for example, something like that, you could have a contribution with the three-point vertex. Let's just focus on the epsilon suppression of it. Okay, so it's got 1, 2, 3, 4 zeta propagators, each of which has a 1 over epsilon, but it's got 2 of those three-point vertices which have an epsilon squared. So you think you're getting a big enhancement, but when you put that together, all the epsilons cancel, and what you really get is gh squared squared, or if you wrote it in terms of the tree result, you get gh squared over epsilon, the tree result, times epsilon gh squared. There are diagrams that can do better at one loop order. So if you have this diagram, that involves gh squared over epsilon to the third, one of those guys, so gh squared. But since you've only got two zetas at the interaction vertex, there's only a epsilon over gh squared squared. And that, in the end, comes out to be gh squared over epsilon times gh squared. So what happens is that the loop expansion is an expansion in powers of this guy rather than this guy. Okay? And the problem is, yes? Questions? The problem is that when you do explicit calculations, as Steve and Martin have done, for example, I think they were the first to show this, the result, the loop corrections to these things wind up having the property that they're sensitive to the infrared cutoff, which must be used to define the propagator. You can already see that the propagator is going to have an infrared problem because the u squared has to have something like 1 over k to the third to cancel that k to the third out there to make it approximately scale invariant. And by the way, violations of scale invariants just make it worse, not better. So that's not a way out. And that means it has to have an infrared cutoff. That doesn't affect the tree order result. But Steve and Martin showed in a great paper that, in fact, it does affect loop corrections to these correlators. Okay, so they are, depending on the infrared cutoff, what the infrared cutoff is might be as big as you want, right, depending on how big a volume you had starting with. And that's, in principle, an exciting result because it means that the loop correction might be observable. But a lot of people have pointed out, well, wait a minute. We need to consider the question of whether or not this is really the observable we want to look at. And many, many people, for example, Yuko, I think, is right there, Hebecker et al., and other people have considered the issue about whether or not if we redefined the observable to make it more nearly an invariant thing rather than just something living in a gauge-fixed version of the theory, it would eliminate the infrared divergence, or the sensitivity on the infrared cutoff. The result is, yes, you can eliminate the sensitivity on the infrared cutoff, but at a price. The price is, one typical fix to these things would be to change that x to being the operator value geodesic, which lives on the surface of constant t and evolves from x vector in the direction of x vector. Okay, that will, if you do that, that will then change the result. Of course, this thing, if you expanded it out perturbatively, would be little x vector, and then it would have a term that would be linear in zeta, a term that would be quadratic at zeta, et cetera. So the operator you're looking at is no longer zeta of t and x times zeta of t and 0, but rather zeta of t and x plus corrections of order zeta squared, zeta to the third, plus dot, 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 times zeta of t and 0. That has some bad properties. First off, it introduces new ultraviolet divergences. This thing is a non-coincident 1PI function. We know how to renormalize those with BPHZ counterterms. That is not. That is a non-local composite operator. We don't know how to do that in general relativity. And again, sometimes people claim, no offense, but a little bit more than they can do. Let me just remind you from particle physics how hard that is. There is exactly one case of a non-local composite operator whose renormalization we understand. That's the Wilson loop that seems to be multiplicatively renormalized. That hasn't even been totally proven for arbitrary paths. And that was the result of a lot of hard work. This is in a more complicated theory, and anybody who says that they know how to renormalize this is maybe taking a few liberties, and I challenge them to do it. That's the first problem. The second problem is, yes?
Yeah, so the thing is that actually, so we propose, the quantity we propose is has that kind of problem, but the crucial point is just to without the, you know, the shift symmetry of the curvature evaluation. So as far as we introduce the quanta term, such that we don't break that, you know, the shift symmetry of the curvature evaluation, so I think, you know, the infinite regularity is secure.
Well, I never questioned the infrared problem.
Right,
the issue is ultraviolet divergence.
What kind of counter terms are allowed?
Okay, so statements like that are all the better for proof. I'd love to see a full-blown renormalization of it. And I don't claim that it can't be done. In fact, I think it can be done, and I think this is an eminently solvable problem that we all should do. And this would be one solid piece of progress that a conference of this level could make that would be a real piece of progress. Yes?
Richard, are you complaining about not being able to do this just to this next order in perturbation theory?
Yes.
Or do you want to prove, okay, so even at just one loop
order? Even at one loop order, I'm not saying it can't be done. I just don't know how to do it.
Okay.
Second issue is, I think, probably less controversial, and that is that these things correspond to what are essentially new interactions. That is, if you looked at how to calculate the correlator of this thing, it would be all the usual diagrams that you got from interaction vertices involving that, but then there would be extra diagrams that would look topologically like this. From this guy hitting there, and from this, they would look, let's see here, I suppose I have to do it like that. No interaction vertices. Let's do the counting of epsilons on that. This guy has 1, 2, 3 zeta propagators, hence, I think you can't see it, some people can't see over here. This guy has 3 zeta propagators, so g squared over epsilon to the third, one of the three-point vertices, so epsilon squared over g h squared. Hence, it's really g h squared over epsilon times g h squared, if I did that. Pardon? Over the what?
Dot.
The dot is a vertex. So this is just that we have a quadratic piece. Let's look at that one. So this one looks like
Richard,
it's conventional.
But you have two other people who need to say something. So how much more time do you need?
One more minute.
Great.
Okay, so let's look at this diagram right here. We have 1, 2 propagators and no factor of epsilon. So we've got a gh squared over epsilon quantity squared, and that would be gh squared over epsilon times gh squared over epsilon. So that would say that the loop counting parameter associated with corrections to that correlator is actually GH squared over epsilon rather than GH squared. Okay? Now maybe that's right. Maybe the penalty for getting rid of the infrared divergence really is to lose the epsilon suppression that is so agonizingly obtained by putting together all those interaction vertices. But it seems a little bit funny to me anyway. And so what I would challenge us to do is to identify observables such that the loop corrections are infrared finite, ultraviolet renormalizable in the sense of BPHZ, or some other composite operator renormalization, and appropriately epsilon suppressed.
But this would not really be a tragedy, right? Because this is still a small number.
It wouldn't be a tragedy. It would be wonderful.
No, so sorry. If the expansion parameter was GH squared over epsilon.
It's a small number.
That's still a small number.
Yeah, it would be, if it was GH squared over epsilon, then we'd know exactly what it is. It's going to be 10 to the minus 9, which is a lot better than 10 to the minus 11. So it'd be wonderful if true, but let's be very, very sure that it's true. And it feels a little bit wrong. You'll agree that it feels a little bit wrong. The vertices all conspire together such that that doesn't happen for the naive correlators, and then an apparently completely arbitrary step of redefining what we mean by the correlator is introducing these new epsilon-enhanced results. It would say, by the way, that we could just throw away all the results from the interaction vertices. We wouldn't even have to care about them. The biggest, the dominant effect would come just from the infrared fixed terms. Maybe that's right. If so, it's very important, by the way. But let's be sure it's right. Okay, sorry for going over. That's it.
Thanks.
So any other questions for Richard before?
Yeah, I do, yes.
Sounds like there are a couple.
Please.
Go ahead, Marty.
In summary, are you saying that even after perturbative renormalization, the effective action is not well-defined?
Well, I think I'm saying that the correlators, so if you're interested in 1PI endpoint functions, then I know how to renormalize all of those, and the effective action that will give you those things is completely well-defined. However, those things will show sensitivity to the infrared cutoff used to define the tree order propagator, which has to be used to define the tree order propagator. So the effective action is well defined, but it's going to be infrared sensitive. There's a new class, the thinking about how to deal with that infrared sensitivity is to define a new class of observables. We heard from Leonardo about one way to do that. Yuko suggested another way to do that, which is very similar. And there's a paper by Hebecker et al. That suggested a way to do that. So there are proposals that will do that, that do in fact work. They do eliminate the infrared sensitivity, but at a price. The price is they change the theory so that we don't know in the sense of just being able to say, look, I know how to do it. This is how you renormalize it. It needs this counterterm, that counterterm, and that counterterm. It changes the thing into a composite operator whose renormalization is not now understood, number one. Number two, it changes the intricate pattern of epsilon suppression and causes the loop counting parameter to have a factor of 1 over epsilon in it, which is a big number. And one thing that might make you very suspicious of this is that this would mean, if this is true, this would mean that in doing loop corrections, you can just forget about all the interaction vertices. Just don't even worry about them. Just pump them out. The whole effect, the big dominant effect by a factor of over 100, is coming just from the things that were used to eliminate the infrared sensitivity. Maybe that's true, and if true, by the way, it's wonderfully important, but let's think hard and be very, very sure that it is true.
Tom had it.
Yeah, I just wanted to, the infrared problems are logarithmic in the infrared cutoff, is that right? There are no
problems. Actually, there can be at at epsilon not equal to zero, there can be powerball infrared divergences.
There are power.
There can be, yes.
Okay. Questions? Don is subtracting from his own time at this point.
In that case, I won't.
He's last. Put that in the pocket.
Do any of these things arise in the center space? So in the center space, you wouldn't have the scalar field?
Well, the center space has epsilon equals zero, so we already have a problem with trying to define epsilon equals zero. We do have infrared issues in De Sitter, and there are very complicated questions about what are the observables in De Sitter. And heated, and one thing that I would like this conference to decide is, or to have us reach agreement on, is what are good observables to measure things that you might be interested in. For example, the quantum gravitational back reaction on the expansion rate. Seems like that should be an observable quantity. What operator should we use to quantify that? And it will, again, be some kind of composite operator to put in the stuff that would have to do with defining how it is that you measure time and what where you're doing the measurement, et cetera. And that raises the issue of how you renormalize it. And there is no analog of epsilon suppression, but it also does raise the issue about whether or not the corrections become more important than the stuff from the interaction vertices, which we're sure are right.
Good discussion to continue. Unless very short comment.
So, what yesterday I think I was trying to show is that these infrared divergences, they will appear in the intermediate part of the calculation. But let's do Kumovic coordinates, the one you like. Choose it and compute something observable that will cancel in the things that are observable. And this is coming from
Leonardo, I don't think I'm disagreeing, but by something that is observable, you mean one of these composite operators, right?
I mean, no, something good all the way to something that you see, the delta T over T that you see in the eyes at 10 degrees.
Is it a non-coincident 1PI function? Yes or no?
I'm very humble, sorry. I just say, the computer, the...
But that's a simple question, right?
You should continue this discussion, definitely.
Well, yesterday we were discussing a lot. Now today not. I martyrized myself, and now, okay, that's fine.
What's
it? I had martyrdom yesterday. I am now discussing.
I just lucky we didn't bring you with us.
Okay, let's move on to Will. And again, this should be encouraged to continue, but a little late.
I don't want to get in the middle of this.
No.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about something that's not cosmological. Okay, it's just about, so the question is just how diffeomorphism invariance is going to change our concept of locality. So it's kind of a broad question. So in QFT, we usually have this, which is sometimes taken as an axiom of microlocality. So you have two scalar operators, say, they're supposed to commute at space-like separations, zero. Okay, and then in GR, we have diff invariance, which essentially says that you can't define such local things. So if you want to define a diff invariant operator, that's going to be something like an integral over your space-time. You know, for example, you could construct something that's the integral of a local density. And these are sort of as removed as possible from these. And so the question that we want to address is, say, you know, can you define something, I'll call, say, capital phi, as sort of a gravitationally dressed version of these phi operators? We want them to sort of become local, when gravity is weak. And then the question is, how close can we get to satisfying something like this microlocality, at what, you know, at what order do we expect these to, you know, so what sort of operators do we expect to construct that are diff invariant to approximate these things? Okay, so this is kind of a very old question. I mean, it was first considered, there's an analogous question first considered in QED. So in QED, you know, if you have a scalar charged operator, say, you know, you can't just define the operator itself, but you can dress it by some Wilson line. So you can have something like integral of A, where now you take your particle and you attach, you know, this line to it, and you have to take, and you take it out to infinity, and that's a gauge invariant thing to do. But it's sort of doesn't have this sort of locality property. So if you take two operators, you know, really sort of say, right, so where the strings line up, and you take one at a slightly later time. So say you have, phi here, and you have phi dot here. Then those will be very non-commuting because of this non, you know, the fact that this A doesn't commute with the A dot coming from here.
The choice of how to extend this Wilson loop to infinity, that's like choosing the electric field, right?
Yeah,
that's physical, right? That's
absolutely. This is a physical choice. You've chosen to describe an operator that is not just an electron, but an electron plus an electric, a singular electric field going off to infinity. So so these are, you know, these operators know about that. They sort of feel each other because of these electric strings going off. My point is just that these are probably not what you usually mean by a local electron operator. You know, it's a very singular sort of highly excited field configuration. And indeed, these commutators are diverge with the length of this string. Okay. So, but there is a modification of this proposed by Dirac, way in the early days of QED, which is just to take basically you construct an electron plus its associated Coulomb field. So. R, and then A sub R. And that's a more local sort of object. You know, it corresponds to the particle plus its field. Okay. All right. And so I just want to take this construction and see and do an analogous thing for gravity at the linearized level.
Okay, but do these phi Dirac, do they commute with each other?
No.
You might mention the connection between them, unless you're saving that.
Good. So indeed they don't. So in fact, say you're just working at the linearized level, you could obtain this just by integrating this over a sphere. So you shoot out, you know, you shoot a Wilson line and sort of average in all directions, and that builds up this field. And indeed, they don't commute. You have something like phi Dirac at x. Phi Dirac dot x prime, and that goes like q squared over r x phi.
So are you telling us there is no sharp statement of microlocality in QED?
For charged operators, yeah. That's what I'm saying. Okay. So you cannot construct local charged operators that can. They go off to infinity. I mean, okay, so it's maybe not. I think it's maybe not too surprising. So you're creating a charged excitation, right? So that has to change the total charge of the, you know, of the state, and the total charge is measurable at infinity. So it has to fail to commute with the field very far away.
No, it makes sense. But since you started from this point, there should be some modification, like operators commute in space-like separation up to Gauss law constraints or something like that.
Yeah, right. Oh, I see. I think that the best statement is something like this, that it depends on what operators you want to construct, and I think that what I'm proposing is that the best things to construct are things that are sort of as low, you know, as local as possible. And this is a.
Isn't phi w more local than phi e?
Well, it depends what you mean. Good. It's more local in the sense that it's exactly zero in more places. When it's not zero, it's really not zero. It's, you know, it's infinity in this sort of IR divergent way.
But, by the way, another related point, of course, as everyone knows, you can have a charge that's positive and a negative charge connected by a Wilson line, and that's something that is concentrated within, you know, a neighborhood, basically, and commutes with everything outside that neighborhood, if that's the actual.
Yeah, well, that's what I was expecting him to tell us.
Things are useful for some things and not for others, and you could ask the question if there's something similar in gravity just as well. So.
Well, you can bring a charge at infinity into, you know, from infinity, but then you get a neutral up.
Yeah.
In the same region that it's commuting, so it doesn't answer the question. By the way, is there any generalization of this Dirac suggestion, whose utility I'm not exactly sure what it is, in the non-abelian theory? Because it's kind of hard to average those non-abelian.
Ah, good. And that has been addressed and used. The construction is a bit different. So this was investigated by Bagan, Lavelle, and McMullen, and probably others. But what they proposed to do was basically to take the Wilson line, but to run it backward in time. And that's basically the operator that they construct. And they argue that that's the right thing to do.
Good.
So it's not yet. but what you have to do, so you have.
That's a
yes.
History, no.
Pardon? Well, yeah, you right. You, now you have to think about non-equal time commutators and so on. But the difference here is that you usually assume your gauge transformations vanish at spatial infinity and not past infinity. So you have to fix this up by adding something like this Dirac thing in the past.
But why not use your alternate recipe for the Dirac? We're just, you know, throwing in the Wilson line and then average over directions the non-abelian case.
Yeah, perhaps you could. We just didn't, you know, we weren't as interested in.
There's actually a much older suggestion of making something smooth in the non-abelian case.
Yes.
Due to Bonfim-Witten,
okay.
Which is to multiply the charge field by the propagator in the background gauge field of the Fine-Witten equation.
Yeah, good. Okay. So,
There are lots of variations on that too. You can do the heat kernel, you can do the propagator. There are a lot of bilocal gauge covariant operators that are completely smooth.
I see.
For smooth external gauge field.
So bilocal, you mean that there's like a positive and negative charge
yeah.
or something?
Yeah,
or something
you take like the propagator yeah, of sure. the Klein-Gordon equation for a charged Klein-Gordon field with the same charge as the local field you want to neutralize. And just take that and take one of the points off to infinity. And in the non-abelian case.
And you take the and you take one of them off to spatial infinity.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like a reasonable thing. Yeah, if you're using like a Klein-Gordon propagator, I imagine you'd have to do something at sort of at scry, and then you have to worry about what happens to your gauge. You know how you deal with the gauge transformations at scry.
But Klein-Gordon has a mass, so yeah.
That's more or less similar to saying that you have the dynamical, some other dynamical fields with the same charge, and your operator is a bilinear of the field you are inserting plus the other.
In some approximation, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, but it's made up of Wilson lines. If you write the Klein-Gordon mm-hmm. propagator as a path integral mm-hmm. over particle paths,
right,
then this is just a path integral over Wilson lines. And the proposal was made in Euclidean space, so scry is not an issue.
But if all of these give you something non-local.
All of these are non-local.
Absolutely. So we were just trying to do is see sort of how we could make something that was kind of, you know, as local as possible in a sort of simple way. So the gravity story is similar, so I'm just going to treat linearized gravity. good. So then our scalar operator has a transformation law like this under diffeomorphisms. And so we're just going to define our new our dressed operator to be phi x plus v, where the transformation rule is that v goes to v minus 6. So basically, you know, we just localize a point in a diff-invariant way. That's and define our scalar operator at that point. Okay. So one can do something similar to this Wilson line construction. You can start at infinity and shoot in a geodesic. You can fix the, you know, fixing its sort of initial conditions and the length. And what that does at the linearized level is it gives you the mu that looks like this. So it's an integral ds. So s is going to be the parameter along here, and u is going to be the normal. Ds of s gamma mu beta u alpha u beta. Okay. And that's very similar to this thing here. They, it's constructing what's sort of an analog of a, you know, a gravitational analog of an electric string. It it fails to commute when the strings line up in a bad way. And
do we expect it to be really the same? Because the in the gauge symmetry in the case of ordinary gauge theory.
Yes.
It's, I mean, x is just a parameter, so the gauge symmetry doesn't act on x at all, right? Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And so you're perfectly fine. You choose some line that goes through x, through any point in x. But here in gravity,
yes,
gauge symmetry acts on x. Right?
That's right.
Not
linearized
level. You said not at
the linearized.
No.
Well, the transformation of phi is now no longer just proportional to phi. It has derivatives of phi at the linearized level. That's the
phi goes to phi plus c mu d mu phi.
Right. This is yeah.
And so the question is how to define something where that dependence on c is removed. Yeah. You had an additional comment, Paul?
Well, I feel that. So this putting this Wilson line, I don't see how will it commute, for example, with the Hamiltonian constraint. How will it be consistent with the Hamiltonian constraint of GR?
So we.
Out, I don't know. Yeah, I just find it intuitively strange. Creating energy at this point and at this position.
So it should. I think it should commute with the linearized constraint, but we should check. I mean, that constraint is really just generating diffeomorphisms. So this statement. I mean, one can check for this that the transformation of V is precisely this under a diffeomorphism.
You should be worried about higher order things because you can find something at linear level.
Can I go to the blackboard?
Yeah, absolutely. So this would have So at higher order, you'd certainly have to correct. You'd have to correct this. You can't just solve. This is only a linearized.
The other slice is a gauge symmetry, and so in one you have the operator, and the other you don't. So that's the kind of thing I was worried about.
Those are different time slices.
Different spatial slices, which are related by. Yeah.
Although he didn't draw his picture was in a spatial slice, so there's a bit of a.
Good. So this will actually, if you do an infinitesimal diffeomorphism, you know, this sort of coordinate location will move off of the t equals zero surface.
So you're talking about only the diffeomorphisms of a three-dimensional?
No, this is invariant under all of them, under four-dimensional diffeomorphisms.
What's meant by linearized gravity in this Because I thought usually when we talked about that, it was a theory of linearized graviton fluctuations plus scalars, and in that context, the gauge transformations only act on linearized gravitons and didn't act on the scalars in linearized order.
But you can work perturbatively in coupling, too.
But then it's not. linearize it. Isn't that that's a second order gravity with usual count?
Right, right. This might work in linearized gravity, so my objection was on
that. But my question is, where do you expect the solution to work? Does it work in linearized gravity as I just defined it, or does it work in second order gravity as I just defined it?
I think it works to leading order perturbatively in the coupling, namely the mass, if you're talking about, say, particle or the energy. And then, of course, you do expect higher order correction.
So it looks better for massless fields than for massive fields?
If you're thinking about the near end, yeah, that's true. It's better, or put differently, if you have a massive thing, it works better when you're further away from it, or the field is weaker.
I'm also confused about Juan's issue. It's not what I think of as linearized gravity.
Maybe this issue doesn't arise in linearized gravity.
No, but this, what Don is saying is that this transformation law for the scalar is not a part of linearized gravity.
As most of us would define it.
Is the background value of the scalar zero? Is
yes.
Okay.
Yes. If there's a background value for the scalar, your linearizing is going to be much of a background. And if that's the gradient of the scalar in the background, then I think that is part of what we described.
I see. So we're going on. We're definitely going beyond the sort of strict quadratic thing because we're yes, that's right. We're considering. We're considering, a quadratic action for gravity, and we're considering a quadratic scalar action plus the interaction term, that's like h mu nu t mu nu.
The same thing would happen in QED if you just set the charge to zero. That's what you would be calling the linearized theory. But we don't want, if you look at the Wilson line, you're working to leading order.
Exactly. We want
first order in this interaction term, in this coupling, you can solve it.
But in QED, you don't change the form of the gauge transformation rule when you turn on the coupling.
No, but you do it for the field. Not abelian Yang mills or something.
Yeah, that's true. But if not abelian Yang mills, a lot of these things get more complicated. So.
No, actually, you do exactly the analogous thing. If you have a scalar and you look at its gauge transformation law, it goes to itself times e to the iq lambda.
The Wilson line solution is a solution, but. The Coulomb one is not for the non-billion pits. You have to do something more sophisticated than the Coulomb field.
But isn't this just analogous to the Coulomb line, the Wilson line solution in QED?
Yes.
You're just adding a particle together with its gravitational field?
Exactly, and its gravitational field is a singular thing confined to some line.
And so here you were satisfying the Gauss law constraint, and so there you should be satisfying the Hamiltonian constraint.
Yes, you are.
Precisely because of this thing that you're writing, right?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a transformation law, right, exactly. There's a transformation law of under a diffeomorphism of this piece here. And it's like delta mu alpha beta is so like d alpha, d beta, c mu, something like that. And yeah, so you get some transformation law from here, and you do this integral, and you pick up a piece at infinity that you assume vanishes, and you pick up also a piece here that cancels the transformation law of the scalar.
And so just to be precise, you didn't write down a Lagrangian, but you're thinking of a scalar with the usual canonical normalization coupled to gravity, and the metric you're going to write down here is the usual one over G in front, is that right?
You mean the
counting of powers of G is slightly different if you work in a theory where you write the usual sort of supergravity form. The one over G is in front of the scalar field kinetic term as well.
That's right. Yeah.
The usual case where you can tune the gravitational interactions.
That's it. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. I think this is
good. Okay. So in analogy to the QED case where you can obtain this Dirac type of solution by just averaging the Wilson line, we're just going to average this thing. And what you wind up with is a V mu that's just given by And if you act on, so, and then acting on, say, the vacuum with this operator just in this way, what you generate is you know, a scalar particle plus a linearized Schwarzschild solution around it. Good. And so one can ask, you know, about the commutators of this, and the story is rather similar. So for so say we consider a commutator like this, at equal times, then there's going to be sort of a, so we'll suppose that we have two particles that are, you know, almost at rest. We're going to neglect the, so there's a time derivative, there's a time derivative here, so phi of x is a linearized order mu d mu phi. There's a time derivative and a space derivative, and we're just going to neglect the spatial derivative. So the leading contribution to this is like e0 at x, 0 at x prime. And one can show that that goes like, so this commutator, sorry, so this should be a dot. So I want to take the commutator with the time derivative. There'll be a dot here and a dot here, just because this is, right, this is, right, so there's one, so there's one time derivative that comes from the fact that I'm considering v naught and another time derivative from the expression. And this goes like restoring g, goes like g over r, and...
But you really want three dots in your expression?
Yeah. Just because the leading... because the leading correction, the sort of most important piece of the gravitational field for a particle that's not moving very fast is coming from the Hamiltonian constraint, and that is a, you know, that corresponds to diffeomorphisms that move this surface in forward in the time direction. So that's where this dot comes from.
It's expanding.
I'm just expanding, and I'm only keeping this term. There are other terms, but this is the one that's relevant. You know, if you just have massive particles at rest. Good, and then, so if we suppose, and if that's the case, then we'll have, you have some time dependence, you know, that's just given by the mass, and so this becomes g, say they have different masses, m1, m2, and then there's phi of x. Good. So that's basically it.
Let me see if I understand. So suppose the initial gravitational field is zero, gamma is zero.
Yes.
Before you do the gauge transformation.
Yes.
You do a gauge transformation, zeta, where zeta is uniform in space, but depends on time. Right?
Okay.
Do things change? I have not seen how these be mu changes under such a transformation.
Good. So let's see.
Like we have radial derivatives of zeta, and those would be.
So you'll have You'll have radial derivatives of
zeta. So that would be zero, right?
Zeta. Pardon?
Would that be zero? That would be zero because if we assume zeta is spatially uniform.
I see. Yeah, you want it to be constant overall. That's right. But that's not a gauge diffeomorphism. That's a global transformation.
Well, no, you, right? You want dependence, but I think you will pick up a time. You'll pick up a v0 term, I think.
Your diffeomorphism is moving everything forward, you know, all the way up to infinity, right?
Yeah.
That's the one you want to talk about? It's just a time translation?
Time-dependent time translation.
Yeah, OK, but I think that's not a.
In the forward space.
But that's the Hamiltonian. That's not one of the things that I'm demanding invariance under. Yeah. Good. Yeah. In general, right. In general, yeah. You'll integrate. In general, you'll integrate this, and there'll be a boundary term which goes like, which is proportional to C at infinity, and it's invariant if you take those derivatives. And then there's another piece that comes from zero, which gives you the transformation law that you need, the transformation law.
So you're only looking at slices that sort of appear at I naught.
Yeah.
You're looking at slices that appear at special infinity.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
So are you saying that we should have expected that the commutator would give us the Newtonian potential? Between the masses, or is this something that's a surprise, or is this something you're happy about?
I didn't expect it going into that, but I think it's.
It jives, I think it with has some other things.
Yeah.
Like the QED result, but also the statement about when you sort of expect to run into obstructions from the gravitational dressing to the usual story of commutativity of local observables.
I mean, if I thought about it, it might be the most natural thing that would appear. Yeah, but.
It's the same thing you'd find if you did a Coulomb gauge transition, for example.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, but working in the right. So, but working in a sort of non gauge fixed form, you see sort of more clearly what is the operator that you're actually working with. That you in your Coulomb gauge you would have just called it phi of x.
Right.
And here it's clear that it's phi of x plus
plus a short. Coulomb gauge phi of x.
Oh, I
perhaps identical.
I think it's identical. It may certainly the first one I defined is the same as the radial gauge phi of x.
One other comment, in the QED case, right, you can have a positive charge and a negative charge, and you can localize, your Wilson line to that neighborhood. Here, gravity is a little different, right? At least in flat space. A similar construction with negative masses. Other questions? Well, do you have more to?
No, I think.
Well, what is the goal? So, what is your rank from this?
I think there are various things you could do. One thing that people are interested in recently is constructing local operators, bulk operators in ADS-CFT. And one of the principles that's been proposed is that you should satisfy this micro-locality condition. And what we're arguing is that you should not expect that. You should expect corrections at this order. And so when you're going looking for those operators, you probably shouldn't.
More generally, the algebra of observables, of the theory, is a very important object. And if we're learning that there aren't the usual kinds of observables with usual locality properties, that's an important lesson for the structure of the theory.
So look, it was what we all knew, there are not local observables in geomorphism and invariant systems. I think this was an attempt to.
Well, it's
something in some sense as close as possible.
Right.
Yes.
See how it breaks, how it fails.
In what sense is it as close as possible? Has any special?
Oh, I see. You want some characterization of all the possibilities.
There's a special weight. You know, after I make a few comments in my part of the literature, I will have some relevant things.
So you want to talk about linear gravity?
Yes.
You want? Okay, then I'll wait.
Plus, we will that way leave Don some comments. But I don't know if there are any other.
I think Vlad has something.
Yep. So if I had two theories, one that's ENM and another theory that's slightly non-local,
Not local in what sense? Like the Lagrangian
is not local. And I start what do I need to compute to determine that one is local and one is non-local? Because like if it was a scalar field, I'd just compute the commutators and see that they vanish space-like separation for one case and not for the other. But what do I do in ENM?
Oh, I see. You want to see that there is some formulation in which the Lagrangian is local. There's that, you know, if somebody gave you the gauge fixed theory to see whether it's a gauge theory or not.
The things we were just discussing, positive charge here, negative charge here, Wilson line connecting them, and see if they commute outside of, you know, in mutually disjoint neighborhoods, for example.
Okay, let me ask the question in the gravity context.
I'll make a very quick comment. In the abelian case, in the old days, of stage theory, for pragmatic reasons, we wanted such an operator that satisfied a criterion, like the least amount of A field possible to define A. So you minimize like the integral of A squared, A mu, A mu over all space. And that's it's the covariant version of Dirac.
Oh, okay.
So basically, that gauge condition, that minimization condition enforces Landau gauge. Mu and mu equals zero, and the phi Dirac, well, at least the covariant version is just phi. This is just the abelian. Okay. So there's some criterion about least disturbing about that.
You can diagonalize the Hamiltonian.
You're going to use that for gravity, you better think of how to use it for the non-abelian theory first.
You could just imagine the configuration of U's that minimizes, you know, U squared or something.
By the way, to amplify on that, if you act with the Wilson line operator, then you'll create an object that then decays because it's got all the E field concentrated in that little string, and that's not a nice eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. So in fact, you expect it to decay to the Coulomb field.
I guess that's related.
It is because it's decaying to sort of the eigenstate, say. And likewise in gravity.
So there are very various conditions you could impose. I hadn't heard about minimizing A squared. Is that it sounds like it would be a Lorentz invariant thing to do. Is it?
We thought about it in Lorentz.
Because
Lorentz invariants.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Because one of the properties of this is that it does pick a frame. You know, is that you. You know, it's the Coulomb, you create the charge plus its Coulomb field in this particular frame.
We would be able to Euclidean space and
So, I wonder what that would mean in the Lorentzian theory then.
It was good for diagnosing stuff or bad.
Yeah. Interesting.
Okay, unless there's anything else pressing, we should move on to Don.
I think David Kabat is going to come next week, and I think there's a claim in a paper by him and collaborators that in the presence of gravity, they can construct local operators.
As local as this. Well, they've done this.
That's the question. Is there a sharp criterion in gravity? So in gauge theory, something has been proposed, right, which is you take, a neutral thing, and you ask that it does exactly commute outside the light cone. But we don't have that sharp criterion in gravity, right? That's what you're saying.
Yeah, well, right.
There's no sharp statement of what it would mean to have locality.
Well, they do have related, but we think slightly different things that they say commute. But there's a little puzzle, actually.
Yeah, no, I'm very much looking forward to
it. Okay, thanks again.
Okay, so the good news, given the time, is I have absolutely nothing new to say. Luckily, this discussion of, if you're going to take some fundamental theory of quantum gravity, which has some set of observables that you know when you see the theory, Tom tells us it's holographic space-time, and he says the Q's are the observables. Or it's ADS-CFT, and we know that, Wilson loops and the gauge theory are good. We want to connect that to local operators satisfying microcausality. Okay, that's an old question. So I can find some old comments to dredge up and tell you that I hope you'll find interesting and certainly kind of relate to the discussion we've been having. All right. So the expectation, and I'm curious as a separate discussion with Tom if this is true in holographic space-time, the expectation is that you have some observable in the full third of quantum gravity, which reduces in some limit to a micro-local observable of local quantum field theory, that it passes through something which is a Diffie-Hellman-invariant observable in some low-energy effective theory of gravity. And so most of the discussion is about things at the low-energy effective theory level because it's non-trivial and concrete. We can say something. So what I'm going to do is just tell you about my favorite, personal preference favorite, construction along these lines, or choice of an observable at the effective level, and I'll explain to you why it remains my favorite despite all of its obvious problems. Okay? So here is my favorite example. This is to be considered as an observable in the non-linear theory of gravity coupled to some set of fields. And it goes like this. Let me just write down an equation, and then I'll tell you what it is. Okay. I'll explain it in words as I go along. You're supposed to imagine that you have some set of scalar fields. I don't care if they're fundamental scalars or if they're built out of curvatures of gravity or what have you. And you have V plus one of them. And what I'm going to do is write down an equation which tells you to go and find where D of those scalars, D being the space-time dimension, have particular values. I need to use those scalars in this intrinsic coordinate system. And then tell me the value of the D plus first scalar. So in four dimensions, you have four scalars that you're using as coordinates, and you ask for the value of the other scalar at those locations. So I can write down an actual equation which encodes that idea. So here's the idea. There are D of these scalar fields, and these are the values I want them to have at the point I'm going to sample. And this is the D plus first scalar that I am sampling. Okay? So I can write the equation corresponding to my words as follows. The integral over the space-time of phi of x. And I'm going to write it this way, some sampling function. And I'm going to include this factor for fun. With respect to x, beta. So the determinant of the gradient of the z's. So the idea is this is to be thought of as some kind of smeared delta function. Ideally, in classical physics, I'd make that a delta function, so this integral is supported exactly at the place where these d scalars have this value. But you know, there's nothing wrong with taking it to be smeared out a function of compact support or a Gaussian. If you want to bother me with questions about trying to renormalize this operator perturbatively, it's much nicer to have some smearing perturbative than we expect to do. All right. So this is my favorite class of observables for the gravitational field. It's Diffie-Hellman-invariant because you're integrating over all space, something which is, this is a scalar function, that's a scalar, and that's a density. So we're good.
And your z's are treated as classical fields, not fluctuating, or?
Oh, no, of course they're fluctuating. They're all fluctuating. They're all fluctuating, full system. Now, this is a great opportunity.
There are configurations where the determinant vanishes.
That is one of the obvious problems with this. Very good. We'll get to that in a moment.
Z is a function of the x's. An operator value of the x's.
Yeah, it's an operator-valued scalar field. So it's the x's are just the coordinates on space-time. Okay, great. So this is Gary's question. It's a great point for me to say that for many reasons, basically simplicity, I'm going to use classical notation and talk about Poisson back brackets or Pyrrhus brackets, partly because I only have a few minutes, and that just saves some details. But yes, you should think of this all as for the quantum problem, and all of these things should fluctuate. And that's relevant to my discussion. But that saves me worrying about, for example, which order I write down these operators in and other details of how you define the composite operators. Let me discuss at the classical level. All right. So there are two obvious problems with trying to use these kinds of observables. One is that, as Tom says, there are many states or situations where this determinant vanishes, okay, where there is no gradient, the scalars, oftentimes the world may not come to you with an intrinsic coordinate system built in. All right, that's just life. For example, in Richard's problem, where he was interested in spatially homogeneous universes, there's no natural coordinate system in space defined by, oh, very important, I want these z's to be local scalars. Okay? So it just doesn't work very well in that context. Oh, well. I guess I would argue that
it's a local scale.
One that satisfies microcausality. as opposed to the geodesic distance from some reference point, which is a non-local scale.
By which you mean microcausality in some gauge fixed perturbative quantum gravity theory. What do you mean by that if you don't have a quantum gravity theory with local observables?
Yeah, fair enough.
Let's see, it has a Lagrangian, which is the standard. C squared.
I want it to be a local function of something with a local Lagrangian.
Yeah.
Sort of
like curvature.
Like R squared or phi grad phi squared or something like that. Good. All right. But I think I would argue that in the sense of classical general relativity, a generic solution to the Einstein's equations, coupled to interesting matter, does have such Zs, at least in small local regions. Because, you know, the curvature scalars, whatever they are going to be non-zero, and they'll have some gradients in every space-time point. Most solutions don't have a symmetry. This raises the other obvious problem.
It's not just the gradients, right? It's the independence of these four functions that's the issue.
Yeah, but if I write down four curvature scalars in a generic solution to the Einstein equations, they're going to be linearly independent in most tiny regions. Now, as I say, this raises the other obvious problem with these things, which is that oftentimes when you have a solution that does have four scalars with the right properties, okay, if I'm interested in a place where the scalars happen to have a value, say, zero, that will often happen at many places in the space-time. So
in the non-abelian gauge theory analog, is having like a colored gauge field and you're in a Higgs configuration?
I think you're
at
Higgs in gravity here.
Right. And, so the Higgs, not a Higgs theory, sometimes is interesting.
Any theory naturally Higgs itself in a generic state, as long as you're not in the vacuum. So away from the vacuum, the problem may be easier than that. Anyway, those are the obvious problems. I don't want to belabor them. I want to explain why I like these and why they remain my favorite despite the obvious problems. Okay? And it's this. So this is the one calculation I wish to do. What happens if you compute the Poisson bracket of two of these guys? So this is O. O tilde is the same thing where you tilde everything, okay, two of these guys, and you do the calculation. Now, calculations of Poisson brackets or Pyrrhos brackets are easy because you just take lots of derivatives of things, okay? And so you see you get two classes of terms. There's, okay, I'll write it this way. There's an integral dx, and there's an integral tilde, coordinates for the tilde guy. The two classes of terms are the terms where you don't differentiate the f's, so there's an f and an f tilde and stuff, okay? And then there's the terms where you do differentiate the f's. So this involves a derivative of f with respect to z alpha, a derivative of f tilde with respect to z tilde beta, and the Poisson bracket or Pyrrhos bracket of z alpha with z beta. And of course, there are also mixed terms. You can derivative of one f and not the other, but never you mind. Okay. So here's my point. Suppose I choose this to be a function of compact support in the z's, just for illustrative purposes. Maybe it's a delta function. Think of it as a delta function. Okay. Then suppose I have a solution, after all. Pyrrhos brackets are functions on the space of classical solutions. So let me evaluate this on some classical solution S. Suppose I happen to be lucky, and I happen to have a classical solution where, if this is a delta function, where z is z naught at exactly one point in that spacetime. Okay, that may not be an uncommon case, but suppose it's true. Okay. And suppose that z is equal to z naught tilde, the diagram of this guy, also at one point. Well, then it's just clear that these f's have supports only at one point. And as a result, the integrals localize. And what lives here, I guess I wrote most explicitly here, is something involving this plus one or Pyrrhos bracket. And since these are local things, coming from a local Lagrangian or functions thereof, this will, in fact, vanish if those two points are space-like separated in this particular solution. Okay. And the same is, of course, true in this term by this constraint and the associated micro-local guys there. So that's why these remain my favorite class of observables, because there is a sense, at least at the classical level, that they remain exactly micro-local, okay? And it's this sense, okay? Where if you evaluate on particular solutions with particular properties, you get the answer you want, all right? Now, at the quantum level, they will not be exactly micro-local, okay? Because there are these issues about, well, it really comes into this old story of factor ordering issues. But the idea is that at the quantum level, commutators have a Leibniz rule, which is a lot like the derivation rule of the Poisson brackets, except that you get those commutators stuck inside all kinds of factors, and you have to commute them to the left, and the expression looks like this. Anyway, if you take a function of compact support, and you try to commute it with something, really commute it with something with a non-trivial commutation relation, it screws up this argument at the quantum level. What that says is that the corresponding quantum commutator, you know, if you evaluate it in some family of quantum states designed to reproduce this nice classical solution in some limit, okay, you should get micro-local commutators for things like this up to corrections at the next order, okay? Basically, at the next order in h-bar. So counting h-bars is relatively easy, and the claim is that these things should be order of h-bar squared. I should have written this as, well, I should say it's micro-local plus order of h-bar squared.
And the h-bar squared terms depend on the distance how in this expansion. Are they power laws like the things we saw in the previous talk, or are they supposed to be exponentially small?
Power laws in the distance?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's an interesting question. I think that depends. That's a good question. I don't know. I haven't thought through that. That's an interesting question, what the actual dependence on the distance is.
What you would guess is that it's going to be the same power law.
You would guess so. You would guess so. Yeah. I'm not certain if this is the...
So you're considering things with compact support, so they're polynomial.
Yeah, so here, this is where you have to decide what's really best, okay? My guess is you're better off taking this to something like a Gaussian, okay? All right, that sort of... That gives you some error already at this classical level, but exponentially small, okay? And it probably is better if you try to compute the commutator with a Gaussian, you get some nicer answer than if you're really trying to make it compact support. Here's your question. What's the dependence on distance? Now, I'm not sure I fully understood the convention in the previous talk, but I think this is smaller in terms of powers of, say, Newton's constant. Okay, because if I apply this to a theory that's just the metric, just Einstein-Hilbert gravity, or something like supergravity, where I just have a 1 over g out in front, then obviously the g's coming together, and so it's this order of the g and h bar are really the same parameters, so this is g squared h bar squared for the size of these corrections. So I think it's small. I think that's my point, is I believe that there's a sense in which these observables have the smallest correction to, well, certainly they appear to have a smaller correction to micro-local causality than anything I can think of. And the sharpest way, a clean way to say that, is at the classical level they have zero correction. Whereas Wilson lines, attaching Wilson lines, clearly gives you a non-zero correction to classical level.
Question about the distance. I don't understand why it's just a function of the distance. Since you have some background field turned on, in general, it would be a function of where you are in the space.
Yeah, it could be, although, if you imagine for simplicity...
You could make it just a constant flux or something.
Yeah, for simplicity, the background fields were just mass, zero modes of a massless field, then there's a shift symmetry that tells you it's really dependent on where you are.
But that wouldn't be the generic version of this.
Right. So it's an interesting question what the general dependence is, and someone could work that out. This story, I think, was being an old one, but I've never computed that correctly explicitly. So I don't know what the answer is.
So what's an example of a background here of a Z that doesn't have vanishing determinants?
Well, okay, the simplest example, conceptually simplest, is imagine that you have four massless scalars, and you turn on their zero modes so that they, you know, have some gradients, all right? And I will do that over some finite region of space.
Space and time.
What's that?
Space and time.
Yeah, space and time, exactly.
By the way, so do you have
So there are all kinds of there are all kinds of interesting infrared issues, which I'm happy to discuss, and they're very interesting if you permit me more time. The simplest thing is to say, let me just do this, have these scaling fields be non-trivial inside some space-time region, and then be trivial outside. Okay, and then as long as they go to zero outside or something, or go to some constants, as long as I choose the z-naughts to represent some value inside an interesting region, not outside, then classically, well, everything I said here is true. Again, there are interesting infrared issues, which I would actually love to talk about, but we're running short on time, so I may not go there.
By the way, there's an example of this in 1 plus 1 dimensions. It's called living on the world sheet, and you can do, you know, explicitly work out some of these things in that simple toy example. So, I think Gary had a comment or question.
Yeah, so Will was arguing that it's very natural if you're going to create a particle with some mass that you create the Coulomb field around it.
Yeah.
That's what I got from his talk, that you just sort of... Now, but these operators don't do that, right? You said they're more local than that? So.
Well, they, of course...
It comes in higher order, or...
Let's see. What, of course, they do is create an excitation at a given place, as referenced by this physical coordinate system.
Okay. But what about the gravitational dressing?
So
they're sort of zero energy. They're probably creating a particle and taking away the energy from the other field.
I think they must be, because I agree. If these things are interesting, they are so local that they commute not only with the Hamiltonian constraint, but with the total Hamiltonian. Because you notice that this is invariant under any time translation as well. Okay.
I see.
So I agree. What they do is they take away energy from the background, and they must put it in the excitation.
I see.
That's something reasonable to do. And that makes them more local. They are, exactly because they are zero energy, they can be more local. They do not change the asymptotic structure of the gravitational field. It also makes them trivial in the vacuum state. Okay, well, you know, trade-offs
alone. Any finite region, we're going to relax to something which is ill defined.
Sorry, what was that? In any finite region? Yeah.
I mean, that energy that's present in those background fields, it defines for you the space-time.
Yeah.
It's going to radiate away.
I'm only interested in the finite region of space-time. It can do whatever it wants in the future. But yes.
Yeah, but you have a prescription that's defined not just for, this has no label about where you are. This is a global prescription.
Yeah.
So you could discuss what happened. So you're going to have to do something pretty horrible in the infrared to make this work everywhere.
I'm happy if it works I am personally happy if it works in particular regions, in particular states. You're right, making it work everywhere is very difficult. And I will say a few more words, I'd love to say a few more words about that. Yes?
I think this is an example of something which is a change in the Lagrangian of the theory. So if you have your original gravity theory and you add a new term in the Lagrangian, so some, and you can view the operator as taking the derivative with respect to that new term in the Lagrangian. This is one example. I mean, we could be adding this to the Lagrangian of the theory, perfectly legal term to add to the Lagrangian.
Yes.
Right? And then take the derivative first to that, and that inserts this operator.
That's right.
In this particular case, the function f was tuned so that the interaction is biggest when these fields are tuned at the particular
exactly
one, and
true.
Then they create a particle there.
Exactly true.
And I think it's probably natural to conjecture that anything that would work in nonlinear gravity should be something like this, a change in the Lagrangian of the theory. I mean, certainly in two-dimensional, in the case of the string Walshett, this
yeah.
is how we construct mm-hmm. operators. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are really changing the Walshett Lagrangian and so on.
Yeah,
and other things are clearly bad for some reason?
Well, they haven't been constructed as far as I know, so I don't know. But this is a construction that obviously works. And then also if you think, suppose you start saying, now I measure the distance between geodesic distance and so on, but then you say, well, who measures the distance? You can say you put a particle propagator, you sum, and then perhaps in the nonlinear theory you have to include that as a dynamical particle. Again, it's again a change in the Lagrangian of the theory. One could ask whether there are any observables which are not a change in the Lagrangian of the theory.
I would leave it to you to tell me which things are really legal ways to change Lagrangian, but I would simply say that, of course, you can compute things like Pyrrhus brackets by thinking of your observable as changing Lagrangian, and indeed, the fact that this is a local change in Lagrangian tells you immediately in that formalism that you get this local response. And if you do something which is non-local, I don't know if that's a legal change to the action or not, but it's certainly not going to be a local response.
So I propose we proceed as follows. We release people who are too hungry to take it any longer, but we continue for those who are interested.
Let me make one 10-second comment, okay? There are all these problems with these variables that we mentioned before, and they have to do with infrared issues largely, okay? I believe that one can fix those up by adding something non-local to these, okay? I think fixing them up does require some non-local adjustments. Steve and I wrote some paper about this a couple years ago. But I think that because you're only using them to fix up the infrared problems, they can give you milder violations of microlocality than you would have if you didn't use this local structure as well. Roughly speaking, one way to fix up a lot of infrared problems is to add one more factor. I will schematically write it this way. Where this is another window type function evaluated on some set of now non-local scalars. And the point is, you can choose you can choose this derivative. You can choose chi to depend very weakly on these non-local scalars because you're just trying to use these non-local things to control these infrared problems, which are kind of subleading. So I'll throw that out as a comment.
Thank you. Again, people should feel free to leave, but go ahead and continue for a bit if you like. People are officially allowed to go.
I will turn my back for
John, I have to make a phone call. I'll come back.
I understand. I don't have that much more to say. I'll be done when you come back, I'm pretty sure. All right. Great. So I was going to say the following. Let's look at applications to our two favorite kinds of contexts, anti-de Sitter space and de Sitter space, and we'll just see what some of the problems are and how big they are. So in the anti-de Sitter context, if you actually try to evaluate these observables in a standard ADS space with standard boundary conditions that are, you know, time translation invariant, well, these things have a problem, which is that their expectation value is actually infinite. Okay. And the problem is just that in anti-de Sitter space or in any context where you're basically in a finite box and the density of states is finite, you get what are basically recurrences. You have a finite energy state, it's going to repeat itself after a while. And so that integral over time is implicit there diverges. In other words, the behavior, well, again, if you set up the initial conditions such that z equals z naught at one point, sometime in the future, it'll do that again. Okay, so that's a problem. Is it a big problem? Well, I don't know. Again, I claim that you can fix that up in principle by inserting some factor of this kind. For example, I could imagine that if my anti-de Sitter space time looks like this, I simply choose some place on the boundary that I happen to like, and I'm going to think of that as k equals 0, okay? And then maybe I start measuring something I'm going to call the, regularized geodesic distance from this surface to various points in the bulk. And I use that as some kind of way to localize my, I use that as my eta. So it is small near the surface, big farther away, and I can insert some weak dependence on this eta to remove this problem.
Okay. So if you were willing to do that, then you could have just done it from the start of having geodesic distance from some points.
I win a bit by combining the two methods, as I can make more quantitative if you like. Let me say it this way. So if I introduce this guy, then it changes this guy and gives me a new non-local term. So now there's an explicit non-local term. Okay? Now, because I'm going to operate at the classical level, the interesting non-local term comes from taking plus on brackets of two of these chi's. You take plus on brackets by taking derivatives. So roughly speaking, this non-local term is proportional to the gradient of the chi's, or it's proportional to one over what I'm going to call the width of that chi function in eta space. Okay. I'm not going to do this very explicitly, but as a factor, let's suppose I'm taking, let's see, do I care about the cross term? I will for the moment consider the term where I take gradients of chi's in both of those intervals. Let's fix that. Okay, so there's some term of that kind. And how big is that term really? Well, that will depend, of course, on how big this recurrence problem is, or what the density of states is. So in the ADS problem, you get certainly a different answer in the confined phase versus the deconfined phase. Okay, in the deconfined phase, the recurrences take exponentially long. This is a really minor problem, and this width can be exponentially large, and it's just clear it's irrelevant compared to what's over there. Let me concentrate on the confined phase, which is maybe less generic, but also an interesting phase for ADS. So no black holes around. In that case, we know that the issue is that, you know, free fields in ADS like to repeat themselves on the ADS timescale, or the ADS thing scale. Okay. So I'm cheating a little bit because this is the width in eta space, but what's really important is this localization scale in real space. So I claim, or hypothesize, or conjecture, that this should be proportional to 1 over the ADS scale squared. Okay. Now, dimensional analysis tells me that if what I want to do is model the size of these terms relative to these terms, I'd better have a dimensionless number here. So I need some length scale on top. And what can that length scale be? Well, this is an effect, this commutator from these non-local terms, something that would be true even in Minkowski space. I wrote down non-local functionals. They would fail to commute in space-like separations. So the only scale that's present here that things could depend on, aside from this W, which became this guy, is the scale that's implicitly present in F. If F is a delta function, it's at a zero-length scale, but it's going to be some regularized thing. So presumably, this looks like, I'll call it LF, divided by LADS squared. So the answer to your question, Veronica, is yes, is if you didn't have this business here, then yes, you'd get a qualitatively similar non-local term. But I claim that by having both types of factors here, by using this only sort of to control these IR issues and making this a weak dependence, and using this to try to do more precise localization, you can make these non-local terms small by this ratio. Okay, so there's a statement.
Can I ask a question? How is this going to work around the vacuum, which is a very interesting state, as you know?
It doesn't work so well in the vacuum.
That's disturbing.
There you go. As I said, one of the well-known problems with this kind of thing is it's not work well in the vacuum. Okay.
That's kind of a distinguished state.
It's a distinguished state. And so that should be an interesting feature. Okay. If we believe this is the best you can do, I'm not going to make that claim, but it's the best that's been presented, you know, today. If you believe this is the best you can do, then you might think that, you know, the problem of recovering locality is better solved, or is that you can just do a better job around non-vacuum states. Maybe vacuum states are harder.
Maybe as some of the discussions said, you know, the non-vacuum states, especially if they're far away, you can hide the Coulomb tails more effectively. But around the vacuum, the Coulomb tails are
very manifest.
Saber-tooth.
Yeah. Or as we said this way, this is observable that by construction adds no energy to the system, commutes exactly with the Hamiltonian. And that's true even with this non-local, it's not true once this non-local thing is added. Okay, right. But the local part annihilates the vacuum. Local part adds no energy and therefore must essentially annihilate the vacuum or act as the identity on it. So again, yes, I agree, they're not going to be anything very interesting in the vacuum. Mm-hmm. There you go. All right, but if you're not in the vacuum, but still in the confined phase, you have just a small term. We could, just for fun, compare it with this term. So this is a term which we argued had to be order of g squared h bar squared. And really what this means is it's the same size as the microlocal term times one more gh bar. And gh bar, of course, looks like the Planck length to the d minus 2 power. But as I said, somewhere here this ought to actually become dimensionless. So there should again be a factor of the localization scale. And so you could try to minimize the sum of that guy plus this guy to figure out, you know, which localization scale gets you the best answer. And so there's some little calculation, and one finds in the confined phase that this suggests the best you can do for localization is some crazy function that looks like L18s squared times the Planck length to the d minus 2 power, and you get the whole thing to the 1 over d power. Okay, some crazy expression. Okay. Good. And again, in the deconfined phase, you'd expect you could do exponentially well in a generic state. And what's a generic state there look like? It's, or the interesting, the simplest generic states where this works well are states where there's a black hole, and at some time it spits out something that acts like a coordinate system for you, and then it falls back into the black hole. And then when it happens to spit out that coordinate system, you can use it. Okay. Now, I should say that, yes, it's true. I was going to say a little bit about the sitter space. Let me back off and say, yes, it's true that these things don't work very well near the vacuum. But there's an interesting order of limits to discuss. If I was in the classical theory, I would need only an arbitrarily small departure from the vacuum to make this work. Depart from zero field at all, generically, it has four things, which are gradients, and it doesn't really matter how strong the gradients are, classically, you can do this. Quantum mechanically, it does. If the gradients are weak, they're all lost in quantum fluctuations. Okay. But so it again depends on what you want to do, okay? But in the, if you're interested in recovering microlocality for classical gravity coupled to matter, you can do that arbitrarily close to the vacuum state. If you're interested in recovering microlocality for the quantum fields, you can't necessarily. Okay. I had only one more comment. Maybe I'll make this brief. Suppose you instead look at the de Sitter problem. Okay. That's one where classically you can, in fact, arrange. Sorry, how do I say this? The de Sitter problem is one where you can arrange these expectation values to be finite. You can imagine, as we have in cosmological inflation, that there's some scalar field that acts like a clock, and it distinguishes points in the middle of the space-time near t equals 0 from those far away. As a result, you can make these integrals converge. What becomes a problem in the de Sitter space turns out to be this guy, for computing the fluctuations of this operator. And that's because if you suppose for the moment that you're working near some background which is really asymptotically de Sitter to both future and past, so let's not worry about the decay of de Sitter space, one of those things, then, okay, each of these guys is some integral over space-time, so that's two integrals. But, you know, in an exactly the sitter invariant vacuum state, things can only depend on the relative separation and not the center of mass. And if it's not exactly the sitter invariant, but it's still asymptotically so in the infinite future, you get the same infrared divergences. So in these cosmological situations, there can be an issue of infrared divergences in the two-point function. And that's at the level of the fluctuations. That's something that Jim and Steve and I talked about a couple of years ago.
You're not really talking about exact de Sitter space, are you, if you have a rolling scalar field, or are you somehow canceling the kinetic energy of that you obtain?
With a rolling scalar field, it's not exactly de Sitter, but it can be asymptotically de Sitter in future and past, because the scalar field freezes after some point. And that's sufficient to make this the expectation value of integral finite. because the clock, the clock rolls between, it freezes in future and past, so it only covers some finite interval.
Okay, right. You're only trying to coordinatize some finite interval.
That's right.
Interval, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
That's right. And the coordination becomes less and less useful near future and past infinity. It's only really useful in the middle.
And where it's useful as in the discussion of the vacuum, it's not actually pure to sitter space. But
yeah,
that's fine.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
You choose some coordinates for time and for space. You're just dividing by the volume in the first.
Oh, I'm going to suppose that I also throw in some other scalar fields which have some spatial gradients. But the hard one is time, because in global coordinates on the sitter space, which is the way that I think it is, I should have emphasized that. I'm thinking of this in global and sitter coordinates. In global coordinates, you can only get an infrared divergence from the interval over time. So let's choose that setup just for the moment. So in that context, there's no IR divergence in the one-point function, but there are IR divergences in the two-point function. And clearly, I'm going to suggest you can cure them in somehow the same way, although maybe it's less obvious exactly what to do in that context. OK. But a similar kind of argument in that context would suggest, so in that context, it's interesting. I should say that, of course, you could worry about divergences and misfluctuations for the anti-sitter case as well, or maybe in Minkowski space. But in those cases, it turns out that although it's formally a volume divergence, the coefficient is zero by energy conservation. So the reason it's non-zero in the sitter space is the fact that the sitter has a temperature. So this problem is at least philosophically related to the Boltzmann brain problem, because the problem is that quantum fluctuations in the vacuum state produce things that look like this reference system off in the distant future and past. Okay. Anyway, but you can imagine throwing in some chi's to work that out, and you can go through some kind of calculation that there's some non-local term suppressed by this sort of LF scale, and I will just write down an answer as a way of conclusion. That this would suggest that in the sitter space, you could localize things in the best cases, perhaps not in your favorite completely homogeneous cases, to this degree. With that kind of crazy dependence on dimensions and parameters. So, there you go. That's what I have to say. Thank you for staying.
Other questions or comments?
Jim.